ישיבת הכותל עם הפנים לעם ישראל.
I don't know to what extent you know Rav Hadary, but there is a metaphysical question. To what extent it's possible to know anybody? To what extent you know yourself? And this metaphysical question with a certain answer, with a certain definition, is a basis of a very famous essay by Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav wrote a great essay, a very profound one, also a very personal one. It's called The Lonely Man of Faith. Lonely Man of Faith, Isha Emunah Boded. And it was written originally in English. You can find it in tradition, I don't know which year exactly, many years ago. And it was translated to the Hebrew. I don't have with me the English edition, so I'm not going to quote from the Hebrew, which already is a translation. But I am interested in using this as a platform for describing what is a man. And that stems from Rav Soloveitchik's analysis, and he compares two descriptions of creation. One description is in Perek Aleph in Bereshit, and the second description is in Perek Bet, in chapter 2. And the two descriptions differ substantially in many words and verbs and ideas. Bereshit Aleph, the lashon is the following: Vayivra Elokim et Adam Betzalmo, Betzalem Elokim bara oto, Zachar veNekeva bara otam. Means that God created man with his shape or whatever, man's shape or Kadosh Baruch Hu's tzelem. Rashi, it's a difficult word, Tzalmo. There's Rambam in Molen Vuchim about it, and Rashi says Tzalmo, he had a kind like a person prepares, an artist prepares a kind of a form in which he puts in gold or any material, and that will get the shape and the form of that framework, of the tavnit, which makes up from copper or iron or whatever. So that is Tzalmo. Betzalem Elokim bara oto, zachar venekeva bara otam, meaning that simultaneously male and female were created. Vayverech otam Elokim, vayom elayim Elokim, pru urvu milu et haaretz vekivshua. You have to fill the earth and conquer it. Urdu bedgat hayam ubof hashamayim b'chol chaya romeset al haaretz. Urdu means literally you have to control them, you have to rule them, you have to rule them, you have to be the rodan. Rodan means dictator in Hebrew, so you have to be their king, you have to be their navigator or whatever, man being the, you know, the greatest creation. It was created at the last day, at the last hour, in order to put him in as a king comes in when everybody is already waiting for him. So man is considered Nezer Abriah, the crown of creation, the crown of the universe, and he comes in when everything is already there. So that is the duty, that is the calling, that is the assignment of man, to fill in creation with meaning, technologically also, and with creating law and order. Now in chapter 2 in Bereshit, the description is quite different. The description there is, Vayitzer Hashem Elokim et Adam afar min Adama. He was created from earth. Vayipach ba'apav nishmat chayim. Here we are listening to the metamorphosis, to the transformation of man from a piece of earth to something divine. Nishmat chayim, mandenafech midilei nafach, the Medrash says. Kosh Bochu, like Kviyochol, gave a part of himself, of his infinite spirituality, and blew it into this piece of earth, to this golem, and made him, gave him life. And nefesh chaya, life, means many, many things in Medrash. Vayita Hashem Elokim gan be'eden mikedem. Kodesh Baruch Hu planted the Gan Eden, paradise. Vayikach Hashem Elokim et ha'adam, vayanicheu be'gan Eden lo'ovda u'leshomra. Meaning man is responsible for cultivating and farming that garden, which is not a simple garden, it's Gan Eden, it's some divine creation as well. And man is there, the guardian, and the gardener, and the caretaker of whatever it means. But it means probably Lo'ovda L'Shomra, like the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, is Lo'ovda L'Shomra is mitzvot eser, mitzvot lo tazeh. That's the place where he worships Hashem, and he establishes the contact and the ways of communication with Hashem. So in the second paragraph, we do not talk about Zohar and Nekeva. The Nekeva comes later, when man realizes Lo tov heyot adam levado, it's not an ideal situation. He needs a wife. And we are talking about Hashem Elokim, not about Elokim, but Hashem Elokim. Man was created alone. He's alone. He's a lonely man. He doesn't have a chavruta. He doesn't have another friend, another creature even with him, because he checked into all the existence of other creatures, animals. And they couldn't find them. Lomatzai is a anecdote. They were not matching up to his expectations. They were not fitting to be his part of his team. Okay? And in the meantime, what he does is, again, with Hashem Elokim, he is worshipping Hashem. So Rav Soloveitchik, to make a long story short, he defines the first type of man is man of honor, man of activity, man of technology, man of man who rules the universe and tries to upgrade it and to exploit it and to make it users friendly, and you name it. That is, I would say, put it simply, the regular, average person who can be very gifted and can be very great, but still his boundaries do not reach beyond what you see, what you sense. It is making the maximum to rule in the best way the world around him, the universe. And he does not need more society, because he has already a wife. It was Zohar v'Nekev Abraham. There was already that nucleus of that friendship, of that unity, which later on creates, children and whole human society. He never spends, according to this psukim, at least when you talk about the feeling of what's going on here, the atmosphere of going on, never spends a minute of longing for more social contact, because he was born with that. Okay? That is the first paragraph. And there we talk about Elohim. By the way, in Kabbalah, Elohim, Gimatria Teva. That's nature. That's a natural man. But and what he has to do, his greatest assignment is milu et ha'aretz v'kivshua, fill the land, fill the planet, and conquer it. Conquering it means owning it and developing it. Lo letohu bara, leshevet yetzara. There is another pasuk. World was created that you should cultivate it, you should create civilization, you should upgrade everything as much as you can with the brains and gifts that Kadosh Baruch Hu has bestowed upon you. That is the first paragraph. The second man, the man described in the second paragraph, is a lonely man. All he has is faith, Kadosh Baruch Hu, not Elohim. Elohim is like the general description of deity. Hashem Elohim is already Shem HaMforash. Here we are talking about the Jewish God. That he has, but he has nothing else. So by definition, that type is not a man of camaraderie and a man who has social life and contacts. He's a man who lives like an individual vis-a-vis his creator, his particular God whom he knows, respects, and worships. That is the second man. Isha Hadar v'Isha Hemuna. Hadar means a man of honor. It's honorable to be a useful citizen who has a good mind and acquires a respectable profession and does the utmost what he can do in order to live his life correctly on the highest level possible. That is honorable. It's an honorable person. Such a person is actually qualifies to be a king. King not in the metaphysical meaning of the word, but, you know, a ruler, a king, prime minister, whatever, president. That is the first man. The second man is a totally spiritual being who, of course, lives in this world, and yet he has a different agenda altogether. His agenda is not to improve, cultivate, and settle this world. His agenda is to deepen his contact with Hashem. And indirectly, of course, even a man of faith, even a totally spiritual person, has certain, prosaic needs. But we are not talking about it. You know, that's not the agenda. That's these things are what in Kabbalah defines a klipah. There is every fruit has, you know, the peel around it or the shell, and this is a necessity, but it's not an ideal. But in the first paragraph, we talk about this world and everything you can do with it and around it and in it. We are talking about it as ultimate assignment and contribution that man can make to his whole existence. Now, this tremendous, it's actually, you know, Rav Soloveitchik was a Brisker. This is Tzvei Dinim, par excellence. You have here two distinct definitions which do not necessarily contradict one of the other. I mean, the definitions do contradict one of the other. But everybody has in him, usually, hopefully, some of, you can put it differently, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But let's put it with the language of the Rav. Everybody has inside him a little part of Isha Hadar, practical person, a technological practical person, and Isha Emuna, the man of ideals, the man of faith. It's intermingled and it's hard to, you know, to divide it and make a surgical incision to say up to here it's a man of practical existence and from here on we are talking about the man of faith. There is no 100% man of faith and there is no 100% man of practice because we are talking here about the idea. About the Tzvei Dinim, about the two possible, I would say, characteristics that characterize man as he was created and as he lives his life till this very day. Using these characteristics, Rav Soloveitchik happens to tell us some very intimate personal feelings. He says he often feels very, very isolated, very lonely, because when a man of faith is not capable of fulfilling God's expectations or his own expectations from himself, okay, he's depressed. He's a person who knows that he has an infinite challenge to meet, because he's dealing with Hashem, who is infinite. And therefore, he's kind of doomed for Sisyphic eternal work. Actually, it's not true, because when you do succeed, even if lo alecha melecha ligmor, ela latchilota, Chazal say, when you get into the line, you get into the dynamics of, you know, perpetually worshipping Hashem and working in spirituality, you already feel, you feel already uplifted, you are happy. In other words, the man of faith is the happiest or the most depressed, because the options are quite critical and dramatic. But the man of honor, the practical simpleton, who all he wants is to, you know, to have a nice house. Once they, Rav Soloveitchik doesn't talk about it, but I remember once some paper I read about some, you know, survey. What is happiness? They asked, I think, people in a few countries. So usually the description of happiness was, I have a nice, maybe a penthouse in the center of the city, center of Rome or London, and I have also, you know, a villa, a kind of something in some rustic whatever, or in the, on the beach. Some kind of holes of there I'm going watering holes of the mighty and the wealthy, and having fun, and I drive at home in London or Rome Jag, and there I have a nice Jeep which I can, you know, use anywhere, something that can even turn into a yacht or a private plane, or have separately these things, and a beautiful woman, and etc., etc. All the things that make life, you know, portrayed nicely in magazines and whatever, you know, to be a bon vivant, having la dolce vita, etc., etc., and enjoying life. Okay, not sinning and not being criminal and not overdoing anything, but still, in English they say it in a more delicate way than in America. In America they say he's filthy rich. In England they would say he's comfortable. Okay, but whatever it is, it means the same thing. This is not something to despise. If a person, especially if he worked up his way from scratch, and he's a self-made man who invested all the effort and all the time diligently reaching, you know, the top, that is something to be very respectable. Such a person deserves respect. And if he's an honorable citizen who is law, abiding to law and respects community standards and everything, and contributes and donates and helps and whatever with his money, not just enjoying himself, then all the more so. He can reach a very high level, but still he's limited as this planet is limited, and this planet is limited. Okay, he cannot reach something metaphysical. The other person, the second man, probably doesn't even enjoy the things that the first man enjoys. But he does have feelings, he does need, he does yearn for support, spiritual support. So he finds it to some extent in God, but he wants also a friend, a chavruta, or chavruta umituta. Okay? And he has a direct contact. Nothing really interferes in the shape of smartphones or iPhones or computers or fancy cars or girlfriends or whatever with his friendship with God, with connection and communication with Hashem. That's the second part. any person can be defined along these lines. And of course, the greater a person is, the more meaningful are his achievements in either territory, so to speak. Chazal say, for instance, that Avot HaKdoshim, who are really epitomize spirituality, they're also wealthy, because Birkat Hashem Hita Ashir. When you are wealthy and you are spiritual, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was wealthy, it means you have a bigger slice from the cake and you can do many more things. Avraham Avinu and the Avot were building up people and whole galaxies. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was very wealthy. He made the project of the codification of the oral law, of writing down and compiling the Mishnah, and so forth. But even if he doesn't have a penny, still, if he is totally spiritual, he is content with it, if he does it in a proper way. And if he fails, and often there are failures, even on the spiritual level, he can become very depressed, very lonely, because then he has nothing. Then he has nothing. He has no money. Or if he has money, he doesn't appreciate money, because he's a man of spirit, he's a man of faith. And if he lost, he lost his faith. He lost God. He lost his only. It's not only. It's everything. But he lost his anchor. He lost anything that can be meaningfully keeping him. Rav Adari, his name means Hadar, man of honor. He was a man who was, in a way, a real extrovert, happy, jovial, person with a presence and with a style. And he was a kind of broadcasting, kingdom. He was almost royal. He was elegantly dressed like a chief rabbi from the Haredi type, with all these Bnei Akiva kids who hardly get dressed or even for Shmona Esrei. And indeed, when he was Rosh Yeshiva, he would frown upon these people. He would say, "You are a soldier in the army of Hashem that is being in a yeshiva, okay? So you have to wear your uniform. And don't go with a t-shirt with all the pictures of this Western subculture on it or whatever. You should have not a white shirt like a Haredi, but you should have something that buttons up and you can put it inside your pants, trousers, and not everybody has to see your toes. And you have to be, respectably dressed, like at least like a member of the parliament or whatever. And talk accordingly. You have to be an honorable soldier of this world." But he would talk to you, usually in coins, in a language. By the way, he had a fantastic Hebrew. I don't know if you can appreciate it. I always said he did not speak English. I'm sure he had talent he was a very talented person, a multi-talented person, very smart, very talented. I think he didn't speak English because he felt he cannot get a perfect comment on the language of Shakespeare. So what, to speak the language of Prince Harry, for that to learn English, or a language of stupid media or TV, internet, for that he would not bother. If he cannot do it perfect, better leave it. Okay, Hebrew he had perfect. He had a beautiful Hebrew, all the layers of Hebrew. The biblical Hebrew, the Mishnah, Chazalic Hebrew, the up-to-date Hebrew, not the cheap slang and vulgar Hebrew you use in a street or army or when you don't find parking and somebody took it. Very high-level literary Hebrew, and people sometimes wouldn't understand it. It would be semi-comical, and he understood. He was a man with a sense of humor. Sometimes he would tell off a boy with some fancy words that nobody understood. saying, why aren't you progressing? Why don't you learn? He would say, Ata medashdesh b'mei afsayim. And he would like, he saw me around, he like winked to me like, this guy doesn't know what I'm talking about. But maybe you translate it to him. He could say it simply. Medashdesh b'mei afsayim means you are like rotating around your own axis. You don't do anything. Medashdesh, meaning like in this rotten water in some puddle. That, but it's a biblical sentence, and he really, you could see that he leaves the language. He leaves Eretz Yisrael. He never left Eretz Yisrael. He never went to Chutz Eretz, and he had plenty of invitations. And also, he never wanted to raise money. He was a proud Israeli tzabar. You know, a proud Israeli tzabar does not go around in shuls and tells horrible stories about 15 children, all of them having cancer. A proud man was born here. He was born in Tel Aviv 84 years ago, grew up here. And Kanimtso Kanhaya. That is the most... I read that in Vienna, in the time of Freud, it was very not honorable, you know, to change your address every now and then. Usually made an effort to get a proper apartment, maybe the parents helped or whatever, and there you lived all your life, or most of your life. And it was planned in such a way that it can house, you know, children and everything, and that is more honorable, to be stable, to be in the same place and not to change everything every year. Okay? I think Novorish, for instance, buys a new Cadillac every half a year or a year. Or today he would buy, because he's Novorish, so he would imitate others, he would buy a Ferrari or a Tesla or I don't know what. They have make more impression on the girls, but a very respectable person, he would buy a good I'm talking about a wealthy one, he would buy a very good Mercedes and keep it, or Volvo, he would keep it for 20-30 years. They usually run pretty well for 20-30 years. That's, I think, the advertisement of one of them, of Mercedes. I think the most Mercedeses that were manufactured ever, still, you can ride with them. So I don't have a Mercedes, so I don't know. I don't have a Cadillac either. But I know that people who don't want to, you know, always impress somebody, they live like... They do have a car, they do have a nice life, they do have the little joys, or maybe even the bigger joys of life, but in a kind of, I would say, I wouldn't say modest way, but not in a novelish way, not in a way that you want to, you know, bombard everybody who sees you how special you are. And Rav Adari was a kind of aristocrat. And when you saw him, that's how you perceived him. Beautiful language, fantastic speaker, ideas, tremendous command of so many disciplines. He knew fantastically Tanakh, Agadah, Morei Nevuchim, Kuzri, Rambam, you name it, and then Hasidut, esoteric things, Rav Kook, then he moved to Rav Utner. I mean, every Sikha, if you bother to listen and you could understand it, then you would go away very, very enriched. It was really a kind of a very special, exhilarating experience to go away from Israel, because it would put together so many things. It was colorful, also having a sense of humor and knowledge of history. He could tell you what happened around the Chozem Lublin when he said this and this word, or where was Rav Kook expected to go the day after that made him, when he said this idea made him angry. It was, so he could tell you, yeah, the day after was the day when he had to go to the inauguration of Hebrew U on Mount Scopus, and it was with a stipulation that they wouldn't teach Bible criticism. But he was afraid of it, and Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld warned him, they will not listen to you. They will, and sure enough, only a year after Hebrew U was established, they started to teach Bible criticism. So he was pressurized. Because of that, he said certain things in a certain style the day before. So when you know the historical context, everything becomes richer. That's what Rav Adari was. He could describe to you in a shiur in Tehillim or Tanakh the geography, the military, preparedness or unpreparedness, the tools and everything. He knew all the scientific background also, which is kosher, which helps you to understand the clothes that these people wore, and the weapons they used, and the diseases they may have had or didn't have. They say, for instance, I remember this Pirush, that Goliath was a typical person with this special syndrome of being a giant with a huge head, which is very sensitive to the smallest, cobblestone that hits his forehead. There is such a medical state in certain people, and that King David diagnosed it and knew how to point and target his the stone he threw at the head of Goliath, and he killed him. So, there are many, many examples. All these are still the man of honor, the great scholar, the great linguist, the person who has such a presence and knows how to speak, when to raise his voice and when to make it soft and this way or that way, when to cry and when to laugh. That is tremendous. Even a great professor and scientist, and it's not necessarily a man of faith, a philosopher. But then there was the Rav Adari, whom you would catch secretly davening with a lot of kavona, going to the Kosel Vasikin every day, a person who helps poor students. He didn't collect money, but he did have some funds that maybe people gave him for that purpose. And he was not a person who would yap, who would know how to keep his mouth shut when it was necessary. He would guard his tongue. You usually would not, you wouldn't catch him with cheap gossip or whatever. He was really a man of honor, but also a man of faith. And one of the proofs that a person is very, very religious and very much believes in his lifestyle is see his family. He doesn't have, and that is very rare, even among Rosh Yeshivot and rabbis. And I know many, many here and there and everywhere, great, great Talmidei Chachomim and rabbis who have descendants, children or grandchildren who are, off the derech. Rav Adari, Baruch Hashem, was zoche to have children and grandchildren, as far as I know, and I mostly know all of them and know the life stories. All of them are yireim v'shleimim in the style that he educated them. So it sounds a little bit boring, and nobody became a hippie, and nobody went to India with drugs and whatever. But nevertheless, that is telling. That is telling what are your inner priorities? What do you really believe in when you are really alone? How do you educate your family? And how consistent you can be. He was a very, in a way, very conservative person. He was very consistent in so many things. And at the same time, he was also very creative. very small. You know, it's even appears in many tourist guides that if you want to see a very special site, come before sunset Friday night to the Kotel, and you will see this procession of after having seen probably the Armenian and the Christian quarter, you will see the procession of these yeshiva soldiers who are dressed with white shirts, white knitted yarmulkes, and in front of them this dancing and prancing rabbi with his long coat and Hamburg Rosh Yeshiva hat. And they're having always the same route and the same songs, Yismuchu b'malchutcha or whatever. And they dance there and then they go back. It appears in certain tourist guides that it was getting a little bit out of control, so much so that the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, Rav Kulitz Zatzal, called up Rav Adar and said, what you do can create Chilul Shabbos, because among the stories there are also Goyim who come, Jews who come, take pictures and come and travel because of that. So you should do it earlier. Rav Adar listened and did it. I don't know how it's done now or recently, but there was that time when he did it half an hour or an hour before sunset, and then they would come back and continue the dancing on the roof of the yeshiva if weather permitted it. I don't know how it's done now, but that's how it was done when Rav Kulitz called him up. Now, why did he do this? Okay, it's a nice thing to do, but it's a minhag that you take for granted. It's a kind of a trademark of Yeshiva HaKotel, like the Rikud HaKotel. But Lel Shabbat, Kabbalat Shabbat. But it goes much more than that. Rav Adari, when he was a person who was thinking, he understood that we are called Yeshiva HaKotel, and we are very much in the proximity, next to the Kotel. So the guys might, see all day the Kotel. So some guys would just, mingle there with all the interesting or strange or fascinating people who are coming there day and night, or try to meet the girls there or whatever. And the more serious but crazy ones might develop a severe syndrome of Jerusalem, being all day in the Kotel with eyes, unfocused. And he wanted to open a yeshiva, not Kotel station or some reservoir for, authentic nuts of Kotel freaks. But you have to give some expression to manifestation of the fact that we are Yeshivat HaKotel. So he took one ceremony, so to speak, one very impressive ceremony at the end of the week, Leil Shabbat, which is the climax also spiritually of the week. It's Shah of Razin, the Razin time of great spiritual revelations for people who have a rich inner emotional religious world. And then you do it. But otherwise, even the entrance to the yeshiva, I remember that there was a meeting of the board. Why do you put the... He was looking into the details of the architecture of the yeshiva, or to do that Aron HaKodesh, you would see the Mokom Kodesh HaKodeshim, exactly focusing it, and he was responsible for putting the entrance where it is. Why not put the entrance where everybody comes up from the Kotel, and then, they would just slide in and having a soft landing into Yeshiva HaKotel, one would give $10, one would give $100, one would give $1,000, one would give 10 cents. But whatever, that's the most normal thing, how to make public relations, how to raise money, how to do everything. No, Rav Adar said, no way. The entrance would be in a way that even Waze will not help you to find it. Only if you really want it, you will find it. You will ask, you will maybe get to Kafix by mistake or the Mizrahi Bank, but you will find it if you really want it. That's how he decided to build it. It was everything that you see exists, this Pinat Beit HaMidrash. It means it's Beit Midrash, but it's Pinat Beit HaMidrash. Here you don't sit and learn Chavruta. Here you have this semi-shurim, the serious shurim you have in the classrooms or shur klali in the Beit Midrash HaGadol. This is Pinat Beit HaMidrash. He was a person who thought deeply also for the future and everything. And as I said, it came from a great feeling of idealism, how to build up Torah in Yerushalayim after the Six-Day War, how to Mekadesh Yerushalayim, Ki Mitzion Tetze Torah Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. And Yeshivat HaKotel really is the greatest representative of Ki Mitzion Tetze Torah Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. Once Yerushalayim became united, became liberated from the Arabs, and that is through Torah. This is the first yeshiva that was established. Parat Yosef was re-established. It existed before 48. But all the yeshivot that existed before 48 were burned down. And so some of them were reopened or whatever. But the new place that can really mark, and you can point it, this is the real Yerushalayim, the Dvar Hashem, the Yotzei Yerushalayim, in honor of the Nisim and Niflaot of 50 years ago, this was it. So that was a man of Emunah, Rav Adari, and being an original individual, he was somewhat lonely, except he managed to form, and with that I'll finish, a very interesting, almost unrivaled friendship with Rabbi Yaakov Katz, Yibadel Lechaim Arukim. They are together already from the age of 10, I think. And that is something Rav Soloveitchik was not zoche to have. Rav Soloveitchik was really a lonely individual. He, again, was friendly, and he knew many people, and many people knew him and respected him, and he had thousands of talmidim and whatever. But he was a lonely man of faith. Avadari had a different dosage of the man of honor and man of society and a man of faith, but he had both. Yizichro Baruch.